Next on Radio St. Pete, a presentation by author and historian Bill DeYoung of St. Pete Catalyst, presented at Happy Hour with the Historian at the St. Petersburg Museum on May the 11th. On a dark, stormy morning, May 9th, 1980, the Sunshine Skyway Bridge, an engineering marvel, was struck by a ship. The southbound span collapsed into Tampa Bay, and moments later, cars and a Greyhound bus drove off the broken bridge, falling into the water below. 35 people lost their lives that day. Bill DeYoung speaking May 11th at the St. Petersburg Museum of History.
Welcome to Happy Hour with Historian. My name is Rui Frias. I'm the director of the Museum of History. There's a lot of new faces here today. I was looking through the list of guests. I'm like, I don't recognize half of these people. So thank you so much for coming and joining. We're proud. This is our 10th season for Happy Hour, and we're excited about another sold-out crowd. So you keep us filled here. Don't miss next month's Happy Hour with Historian. We have author Robert Jacob. He'll be detailing Andrew Jackson's life from the Battle of New Orleans to the invasion of Spanish Florida. So, people aren't too kind to him in the history books now, so we'll see what Robert has to say about General / Mr. President Jackson. Some special thanks to the City of St. Petersburg, the Boehner Charitable Trust, the Benoit Hotel, Tampa Bay Times, Florida Humanities, the Pinellas Community Foundation, the residents at 400 Central, and the Red Apple Group, which are the title sponsors of our civil rights exhibit, and Adelphi Trust, who just signed on to sponsor our new women's exhibit that will open on the 8th of June to the public. If you're a member, you'll be getting an invite for a preview party on June 7th. The exhibit is called Meddling, the Women Who Built St. Petersburg. Listen, a historian said that a long time ago, okay? That these meddling women of St. Petersburg built the city. Of course, we want to thank our presenting sponsor of Happy Hour with a Historian. Without Southern Roots Realty, we wouldn't be able to bring in the speakers that we have. So tonight's speaker has enjoyed a 35-year career with Florida newspapers, but instead of retiring, he is now a senior writer and editor for the St. Pete Catalyst. In his spare time, he's authored 5 books. Is that right, Bob?
6.
6 books, including the amazing...
Spare time, what's that?
including the amazing Vintage St. Pete series. And I'm sure he'll tell you more about it. He's working on his third version of that, so we can't wait to see it. Like when JFK was shot or the attacks of 9/11, if you were living in Tampa Bay, the Tampa area in 1980, you remember where you were when you heard that the Sunshine Skyway was struck. So here to speak about that tragic day and his book, Skyway, the True Story of Tampa Bay's Signature Bridge and the Man Who Brought It Down, ladies and gentlemen, Bill DeYoung.
That's exactly what it looked like on the morning of the 9th of May, 1980. This was 43 years and 2 days ago. We're in anniversary week. Rui was talking about how this is one of those defining moments, especially for those of us who were living here then. And I'm sure that there's quite a few of you here who remember it. It is kind of like our JFK moment. JFK was assassinated during my 5th birthday party, by the way, in 1963. I'll tell you all kinds of stories. And also, this discussion tonight is for those of you who have come to this area since and maybe have only heard about this. And maybe you've heard one thing or another. Some of them are fascinating history. Some of the facts, quote unquote, that we have learned aren't facts. They aren't true. There's a lot of selective memory, and memory plays tricks on us all, and funny things happen over the years. We're going to talk about that in the middle of tonight's discussion about what we call urban myths about the collapse of the Skyway Bridge. 15 miles across from southern Pinellas County to northern Manatee County. And they had been talking about bridging this for quite a while. They talked about maybe putting a tunnel into there, which is a pretty stupid idea in Florida. So that wasn't going to work. The main issue really is that the shipping channel into Port Manatee and Port Tampa dissects Tampa Bay right out there in the middle. So whatever they did, they had to accommodate a 24-hour parade of giant ships, which is kind of what happened here. Before the Skyway was built in 1954, we're going to talk about that. You made the 45-minute crossing in a ferry boat. It was called the V-Line Ferry. It was a small fleet of big belly boats that carried cars and people. From whoever, I can't imagine anybody really wanted to, but wanted to cut down to Palmetto. And I love that area. We're talking about the 50s, though. Okay? The very early 50s. It was about a 45-minute trip. And the Sunshine Skyway Bridge was then and is now a series of smaller causeways and filled areas. The actual overwater bridge is just over 5 miles long. And that's where the trouble comes in. So if my button does the right thing, we're actually going to be transformed back into the mid-50s here in a second. Kids out for a joyride. Does anybody actually know how deep Tampa Bay is?
12 feet, 13 feet,
something like that. And so, how do these ships, which can go up to 15, 20, 30 feet draft under the water, how do they get into the port? Well, they dredged a shipping channel. And they dredged it straight down the middle, which meant that this bridge, which went 150 feet up in the air, did that because the ships were coming in, and they built it right over that shipping channel. Okay, lots of stuff to talk about here. Let's go back to Labor Day in 1954. This is the St. Petersburg Times from the day the Skyway was dedicated. This section had 15 separate sections in it, this special edition, I should say. 15 sections, most of them advertising. Most of the advertising for resorts on the Gulf beaches, they called them resorts even in 1954, or mom-and-pop motels then. But I think more importantly, tons of advertising for Manatee and Sarasota County beaches, and their mom-and-pop motels too. This was very tourism-driven. This is when they started calling the Treasure Island the, oh my God, what do they call it? The Emerald Isles or something. And basically, it was tourist driven. This thing had a lot of a lot of details about the bridge. And as I say, it's mostly advertising. And I stumbled on that, so I'm going to get right to the opening day photo. I love this picture. This gives you an idea of just how pretty weird this thing was. You know, I remember I was a little kid going over this bridge with my dad, and I can remember thinking it was so high up that we were going to drive on the top of those record set things. It literally felt like, and some of you will remember this, it literally felt like a roller coaster. It was this 5-degree incline. It was almost like you went slowly up it, hit the top, and you zoomed over the other side. And suddenly you're in Manistee County. The center of the bridge is actually in Hillsborough County, which will come into play when the sheriff's department gets involved in the future. And anyway, this is opening day. 70,000 cars went over the bridge with no toll that day. It was supposed to be a free bridge once the bonds were paid off, which of course never happened. So it has never at any time been a free bridge. So, fast forward a little bit into the mid-60s, the federal interstate system is creeping its way down through Florida, okay, in order to be considered part of the, or used as part of the interstate system. This bridge has to be 4 lanes. This is a 2-lane bridge. It's 150 feet in the air. It's 2 lanes. It's scary as hell. There's no lights on it. You should have tried driving over this at midnight. Okay? So, they have to make it 4 lanes. What are they going to do? Oh, the other thing is right at the same time, they're getting reports from the road board, which is what the Department of Transportation was called in those days, that the concrete is cracking. The concrete is cracking, and these gaps are forming, and it produces this effect which is known as spalling, which means that the harsh marine environment is getting in and corroding the steel rebar inside of this pre-stressed concrete. Okay, so, in their infinite wisdom. The other thing is that Disney World is coming. Disney World is coming. And Hayden Burns, the governor, knew that we had to get this interstate in here because things were going to change. He was in bed with Disney. He was one of the ones who allowed him to buy up all that property in Central Florida for pennies on the dollar. Okay, so instead of, let's tear this rickety-ass thing down, built a modern bridge, they built a second one. They go back into the file cabinet and get the blueprints for the 1954 bridge, and they just build a twin. And so the two lanes on the right, this is the west side facing Tampa Bay, those are going to take the south. The two lanes on the left coming up from Manatee County and the Pinellas, they're going to take people north. Still no lights on this bridge, by the way. Two lanes. And I don't know if my red pointer's working. I'm just going to go off and do this. I want to point something out to you. You see these weird little feet here? Okay, this is the new bridge. That came about because they were so stupid, they used what they called bottom-boring data from 1954 to build this bridge. They said, okay, we only need to go down a certain depth to plant these pylons to make sure this thing stays up. But they were in a different place. So when they plant the pylons, they start to tilt. This is $3 million in 2 years of their time to fix that. And that's what those feet are right there. I also want to point out to you, this is going to come into play in a minute. This is what protected you and me from ships, okay? These are crash walls. They're maybe 15 feet high, but these things are about 7 feet high. They're wooden pylons. Back in 1954, there were boards, 2-foot boards attached to it. That's going to keep a 30,000-ton ship from knocking that bridge. The idiocy of the whole thing is beyond comprehension. Now, what happens? The road board is starting. They're starting to get reports because they have to inspect that every other year. I mean, it's important. I've seen all the reports. They're coming back, and by the mid-70s, the new bridge, which opened in 71. It's getting worse reports than the old bridge. This thing's already, it's not falling apart. They would have closed it. But the concrete is splitting and cracking. The caps, which are holding the roadway, are starting to show wear. There's a percentage system, and they said within a couple of years, we're going to have to replace this bridge. Okay, because it's unsafe. Meanwhile, the interstate still isn't here. 1978. This is an 800-foot freighter called Phosphor Conveyor. It's coming out of the port of Tampa laden with phosphorus. about half a mile from the Skyway Bridge, the engine fails. And the pilot, who's now named Jeff Schiffmacher, who's not with us anymore, was able to ground his ship through the anchors, up and ground it, and it ground to a halt 40 feet from the Skyway. This is how we took our lives in our hands in those days. Okay, this gets the Times to write this story. He goes, Don North, the writer, goes to Jack Roberts, who's the engineer in chief of the OT and head of Skyway maintenance, and says, "What can make the Skyway Bridge fall down, Jack?" And he said, "Well, if you read the story," he said, "I think any of these ships going through there could do it. They're pretty heavy." Okay. And so the writer presses him and he says, "There are bridges in this country that have fendering systems, that have concrete fenders. You know, notwithstanding the wooden poles and the piling, the wooden pilings that you have, should we do that? Should we invest in protecting civilian traffic?" And Jack Roberts literally says, "How far should we go to protect our houses from falling airplanes?" He says it in this, we should look it up, it's June of 1478. He says, "You know, should we put metal sheets over our houses so in case an airplane falls, we're protected?" In other words, saying the odds of this happening are pretty slim. Okay, what's happening privately, Roberts is getting reports that the bridges are in really bad shape. He can't tell the writer this. The writer gets a hold of some of the data anyway, but Roberts is all smiles throughout the whole thing. Let me introduce you to John Eugene Laro from Queens, New York. In 1980, he was 37 years old. He had been on the Harbor Pilot Bar in Tampa Bay for about 3 years. John was the first person hired under a new Florida law, which took nepotism off the table, which took cronyism off the table, and boy, they hated him for it. So there he is. I learned a lot about John as I was writing this book, and you're about to learn a lot about him, too. You're my captive audience, right? Anyway, let me talk to you. John's a Harvard pilot, and by the time May 1980 comes around, he had passed under the Skyway Bridge on the ship, in control of the ship, almost 900 times. Everybody had incidents. Everybody clipped the piling here and there. Stuff happened all the time. It was all reported in Tallahassee, and there were lots and lots of, as I said, little accidents. All the pilots had minor. John was not the best pilot they had. John was not the worst pilot they had by a long shot. He did have a couple friends, by the way, but it was rough going for him for a while. Let me tell you what a Harvard pilot does. Okay, this ship comes in from across the Gulf of Mexico. Usually it's either laden or it's empty. It's going to pick something up. The Harvard pilot is ferried out on a boat out to what's called the Sea Buoy out by Admiral Key. And then he's in command of the ship. He has to be in command of the ship. He takes it over from the ship's master, whatever nationality it is, whatever flag the ship is flying, because the harbor pilot knows the harbor. He knows how to get this ship into where it needs to go. And this is actual footage of just of a ship making that transit into Tampa Bay. So on the morning of May 9th, 1980, John has been at the harbor pilot's, the pilot station. He was sleeping in his cabin on Egmont Key to board this ship at about 5:30 in the morning. Summit Venture, it's called Motor Vessel Summit Venture. It was flying the Liberian flag with a Chinese crew. It's actually owned by a Hong Kong shipping company, but they flew the Liberian flag as a tax dock, essentially. So when you see all the reporting that you're going to see in a minute, they was flying the Liberian flag. Okay, so he's on some adventure. They're going in to pick up a load of phosphate from the port of Tampa. This ship, unladen, weighs just under 20,000 tons. It is 606 feet long. About half a mile from the Skyway Bridge, 20 minutes after 7 in the morning, this happens.
Thank you.
understand that. That was actually Captain Lara's testimony as to what happened. And I wrote a play about 2 years ago that was called Mayday, and that's Michael Horn, who's a great actor and a friend of mine, doing that. The sound mix is pretty terrible, I'll admit. But I wanted you to see just how urgent it was. Coming back to Mainline for a minute, let me read you something. At 7:30 a.m., scattered showers and a very few heavy thunder showers were embedded in a large area of rain that stretched across the state from St. Augustine and Titusville to Englewood and Cross City, then west and southwest into the Gulf for 100 miles. Movement was to the east at 35 miles an hour. 6:30 a.m., that's the National Weather Service radar summary that morning. In other words, nobody saw this storm coming. Absolutely nobody saw it coming. Lara saw it. He saw it on the one working shipboard radar on some adventure when it was behind him, and Captain Atkins, his co-pilot, said, "I've never seen anything moving this fast." There were mitigating circumstances why he couldn't turn around, why he couldn't ground the ship off to port, why he couldn't, off to starboard rather, why he couldn't turn it around in the channel, which I won't bore you with here, but he could. He made the best decision he could.
St. Petersburg.
You know, I sometimes think of this day as the moment in time that St. Petersburg lost its innocence. I was 21, I think, when this happened. And, you know, there have been murders and various sort of awful, deadly, fatal, nasty things happen. But they were sporadic, and for the most part, I remember thinking that we sort of lived in Mayberry. St. Petersburg was a pretty boring place in those days, too, by the way. The biggest tragedies were like, oh, the food was bad at the Showboat Dinner Theater. And the lights were out at the shuffleboard court. This was a game changer. Nobody expected this. This is actually silent footage that nobody's ever seen. That was shot, I got it from a video guy who worked for WTV. It was shot the next morning, I think. 35 people died. There were 26 people on the Greyhound bus, including a young mother with her 6-month-old baby from Tallahassee, two sisters traveling from Canada on vacation, two couples from Canada traveling on vacation, 92-year-old woman from St. Petersburg who was going down to catch a flight in Miami because she had the international flight she couldn't take in Tampa in those days to go to visit her family in Sweden. There were five students from Tuskegee Institute going home to visit their mothers because it was Mother's Day weekend. And they all died. And here are some pictures too to show you. The bus inverted and landed on its roof. Give you a little sense of scale to what we're looking at here. Mr. Hornbuckle was a used car dealer. This was his Buick LeSabre, 1976, canary yellow. His pride and joy. You know, this morning, at 7:34 when this happened, he had three of his cronies with him, old retired, retired guys. And what they would do every couple of weeks is they would go to other car lots and he would have his friends drive the cars back to the lots. He bought three cars, you know, I think it was Avon Park or Sebring, one of those places because they're really close to each other. And that's where the old guys were, and they were old guys. And that's where they were going that day. Suddenly, St. Petersburg was in the national news.
The St. Petersburg Highway Department had to collapse the Tampa Bay Bridge yesterday in order to apprehend a car that drove onto the bridge without paying a toll.
This is Webster McIntyre of Gulfport. West, in his little 1974 Chevy Courier pickup truck, was headed to a place where he had temporary work in Bradenton. Palmetto, actually. I get them mixed up sometimes, but this was the first vehicle to go over. He was the only survivor of 36 people who went into the water. Wes's story kind of goes like this. He described the bridge shaking, and then suddenly he was flung violently to the left. He found himself riding down on the roadway. There's my battery cover. Riding down on the roadway as it fell. And he flew off the edge, and he ricocheted off the ship. Sank to the bottom of the shipping channel. He'd been a swimmer in World War II. He was in the Navy, and he really knew how to hold his breath 40 feet deep. He was 59 years old at the time. That's his truck in the junkyard with Wes visiting it. He told his family, well, that day in the hospital, I'm going to just rinse all the salt out of it together and get it fixed up and get it good. While some adventure was in dry dock in Tampa during the hearings for the next couple of weeks, Weston and his wife Betty, that's there on the left. They got permission from the Coast Guard to go and visit the ship and tell the crew thank you for saving my life. That's a little cake that Betty made. And on one side it says thanks, and the other side it says thanks in Mandarin. And that is Captain Lou there in the middle in the white. And he was the master of the ship that Captain Morrow was piloting that day. They all testified. I've read every page of the transcripts. And again, we're going to talk about that. The thing about Wes McIntyre, see, he toured the ship and had his picture taken. That's the wheelhouse of some adventure, right where it all happened. The thing about Wes was that he suffered from survivor guilt, post-traumatic stress disorder. He talked about how he when he sputtered to the surface and grabbed the silver girders that were there, he's looking around for people. He's a swimmer. He can save. There was nobody to save. And he lived with that for the rest of his life. And spent the restitution money he got on psychiatric pills and never really could work again. Very sad story. Here's something from the archive.
Number one, what is your name, please?
Wesley McIntyre.
Number two.
My name is Wesley McIntyre.
And number three.
Hang on a minute.
I screwed up. My button wasn't supposed to push. Hang on. Talk amongst yourselves. It's what's supposed to happen. I apologize. Okay.
Bus 4508, 7:30 in the morning on May 9th, he would go down there and wait for the bus and say, I got your back, you guys. That's what he's doing. Every year. He passed away in 1989 of cancer.
Never got over it.
I want to talk a little bit about every anniversary, every time May 9th rolls around, this comes up on social media. Rightfully so, because it affected all of us. And everyone who was here, and maybe as we were saying, heard about it, has something that they remember about it or that they want to share. You know, unfortunately, there's a lot of misinformation that's still out there. So I want to just go over a couple of these things, which we call urban myths, with you guys. Take them home and tell your friends about it, okay? Because every year this stuff comes up, and especially about Captain Lara, which we'll get to. Rumor number one, it was foggy that morning. There was no fog that morning, folks. There was no fog. The visibility was clear. There's a little bit of drizzle. Every single pilot on the bay, and they talked constantly on the radio. They talked about weather. There was no fog. There was no fog. Another one I heard this week, which I really love, is that the pilot ignored orders because of the fog to stop, discontinue his transit. Well, if you know anything about harbor pilots, there's nobody telling them what to do. They're working fairly independently with contact with everybody else and with two radars, and there's nobody saying, we're watching you, you need to stop. That's a load of bullshit, okay? So let's take that one. Third, Mr. Hornbuckle, whose name was Paul, not Richard, as they always call him, because his nickname was Dick, and nobody in the media ever bothered to find out that his name wasn't Richard. That drives me crazy. The story is that he went back to his trunk to get his golf clubs. This happens to be true. Yeah, I got one. I got one there for you. What happens is when Hornbuckle and his three buds very gently push those big Buick doors open and crawl up the grades to get back, the three of them make it up the concrete, and they turn around, and Hornbuckle is still at the car. And what he's doing is he's closing the doors because he loves his car. And he doesn't want to win, take it over the extra foot and a half, you know, and do the drop. So what's true is that they're yelling at him incredulously. He gets his keys out, and he goes back to his trunk to get his golf clubs. Because Dick had a gang the next day. Dick was a fairly scrappy guy. They convinced him that that was a bad idea, that he was going to fall. And so he abandoned that, did not get his golf clubs. They eventually towed his car. I have pictures of that. The guy from the gas station with the hook and the chain was thrilled, let me tell you. He told the reporter, he said, I figured if something happened to the car, you know, some insurance company would take care of it. But a good set of golf clubs? That's like an old faithful pair of shoes. You got any more in there? I didn't want to lose them. Meanwhile, everybody's got to find somebody to blame, right? How the heck did this happen?
From Tampa Bay, Florida, the revelation today that the pilot of the freighter had crashed into a bridge, killing 32 people, and bumped into the same bridge earlier this year and was in fact under investigation for the incident. Divers continued their vigorous search for bodies. A boss and at least two vehicles plunged into the bay yesterday when the freighter struck the Sunshine Skyway Bridge. In Tampa, Florida, a Marine Corps investigation heard from the man who was guiding a ship through Tampa Bay May 9th when the ship hit the bridge, killing 35 people. We have a report from Chris Ruggalo, station of WFLA TV.
During this testimony, Harbor pilot John Lero said blinding rains hit just as his vessel approached the Sunshine Skyway. He thought he was too close to drop anchor. Lero said he thought he would pass under the bridge at the correct point, but a mistaken sighting of a channel marker sent him off course. He claims an oncoming vessel and heavy winds kept him from turning. Everything happened too fast. Lero has piloted vessels in and out of Tampa Bay 789 times. He hit the Sunshine Skyway once before in a minor collision. Investigators could recommend the Pilot Association pull his license. Local officials could charge him with criminal negligence.
Well, they did pull his license. His wife left him. He was a pariah in the community. The guys on radio, and it was mostly radio in those days, made all kinds of fun of him. When he was going to Maritime Academy, he was in Maritime Academy in New York, Don had been a ballet dancer. And boy, they had a field day with that. You know, look at this guy. Must have been drunk. Here is the number one urban myth that pisses me off and should really, righteous indignation should rise in all of you. The pilot was drunk. John Laro was a professional. John Laro was on this ship at 5:20 that morning. As I said, they get the numbers wrong, but he'd done this 900 times already. And most importantly, John Laro did not drink alcohol. Didn't drink. And I still hear it. I still hear it every year on social media. Well, you know, it was a drunk pilot. Or else, oh, you know, it was foggy that morning. Or, you know, they told him to stop and he was crazy and reckless. None of that's true. None of that is true. And when you hear what this man had to go through for the rest of his life, you may cut him a little bit of slack. This is John during the hearings that Steve Yarrett, the world-famous Tampa Bay lawyer on the left, who was the admiralty attorney working with the pilots. They gave his license back. They had to. Because what happened was it was determined in court that it was the weather. There was a cell which we now know to be called a macro burst. I see a guy nodding here, so he must know this story too. Right in that squall that came over, and it literally exploded during the 2 minutes he was traversing under the bridge. That's what happened. Those were 80-mile-an-hour winds, and it blew the vessel sideways as he's trying to make this ridiculous turn they used to have to stay in the channel and go under the bridge. None of that matters because it ruined John Laro's life. And almost immediately within a year, he develops multiple sclerosis, which they assume had been in his nerves and his muscles and his bones for years and years, but it's exacerbated by, guess what? Extreme stress. Okay? So John, God love him, has to quit piloting because he can't move up and down ships anymore.
John Laro will go to his grave with that morning etched in his mind's eye, with the guilt of 6 years and exoneration by the court's cannon race, the sight of the cars and the bustle of passengers falling 150 feet, the television coverage of the bodies coming ashore. None of it will ever go away.
I'm on human side. To John Laro, that's the one side the newspapers were not showing.
And active God Laro says will not be any cheap Hollywood splash. It's director. Executive producer had credits like Star Wars and Kelly's Heroes. With an opening budget of $10 million, Laro will be the focus against the backdrop of the freak rainstorm that blinded him when it was too late to stop some adventure from her fate.
It's an assassination picture, but in addition, it's a courtroom drama and the intensely personal, private agony of an individual.
We were from the south side, and I saw how the head of the wind were in the room.
And the victims, I'm sure this will not be exploited, but the fact is, it happened. As much as we like it, if we can go back to Maine and remake the movie, I have these two ghosts right here.
With these story awards as a starting point, the film will begin production early next year. Then, with a little luck, it should be in the theaters by the fall of 1987. More on that, Pulse 13, Tampa.
Star Wars? Nah. Are you kidding? This thing, I've read the script. It's embarrassing, and you know, with all due respect given to Steve Yarrett, nobody should have ever taken any of that seriously. But I wanted to show you that. It never got made, by the way. I wanted to show you that just to show you what John was trying to do. Eventually, this fell apart. He went back to school. He went back to USF and got a master's in counseling. Exactly. Crisis counseling, which he did for a while until his disease rendered him unable to essentially move. Meanwhile, Tampa Bay is focused on this. Okay. Hello.
This milestone marks the official completion of the new Sunshine Skyway Bridge. Today, the final segment, weighing 160 tons, was gently lifted into place.
Something that might make you feel uncomfortable if you see it and no one explains it to you is the gap that still remains between the two spans. It's there intentionally.
The gap will be filled with concrete. on shore is there to stay.
We hold the second supply for like a day, and then we fill the gap up with concrete, and then we release the jacks, and it puts all that concrete in compression.
The total cost of this, the largest bridge of its kind in the world, is estimated at $220 million. Its length is 4.8 miles. There are enough tensioning cables to stretch from St. Petersburg to New York. The builders said a lot of blood, sweat, and tears went into the project. Its conception came of necessity after the tragedy of May 9, 1980. 35 people died when a freighter rammed the southbound span. When investigators said the old bridge had a series of flaws in design and construction, the state decided to build a new one, one that would last for at least the next 100 years. Tragedy continued to haunt the Skyway. Three workers were killed in two construction accidents. This one, ironically, happened 6 years to the day after the 1980 Skyway accident.
And when we heard there had been a fatality, the second thing I think we all thought of was, why did it happen today?
All of that makes today's completion a bittersweet victory, but it's a day when the engineers finally took time to give themselves a pat on the back.
But at no time was Paul ever anything other than the best, and we're completely pleased with the project.
If finishing touches go as scheduled, you could be driving over the new Skyway early next year. Cheryl Hackison, Volks 13, at the Sunshine Skyway.
So what did they do? It was $244 million. French design that Governor Bob Graham brought back. This is what you call a cable stay bridge. It's a different design from the old cantilever. This is all boring bridge stuff, but it's better. It's more modern. They moved it back a few thousand yards to straighten out that awkward dogleg turn that I briefly mentioned, so pilots wouldn't have to deal with that anymore. And that's what caught Laro in that sudden. That was a 2-minute storm. They raised it up to 200 feet because ships are getting bigger. They widened the channel from 800 to, I think, 1,200 feet now. It's very, very wide. They're still talking about, because passenger ships keep getting bigger and bigger, they're going to have to tear this down and build a bigger one. They put in warning systems because there was no warning system on the old bridge at all. Traffic warning and ship warning, letting them know kind of what's up there at the time. There are lights on the bridge. Finally, we called this a new bridge. It opened in 87. We still call it the new bridge. And I think most importantly, as you've noticed, it's surrounded by bumpers. It's like a big bumper pool cable. They call these dolphins. That was another $50 million. And I like these pictures because they show you what was left of the old bridge with the quote-unquote new bridge going in. It was 1994, I think, before they actually tore down the old spans. That's what the fishing piers are, what's left of them now. What of John Laro? Well, after he decided, or was forced to decide, that he couldn't work anymore, and he couldn't work as a therapist anymore, he basically became, an invalid, stay-at-home invalid. This photograph, this is the last known photograph of him in 2002. That's Wake Boggs and Steve Yerrick, his lawyer. It's the last time that they took John out in the bay and passed under the Skyway. And everybody got very emotional, and John died from MS in August of 2002.
On the approach to the new Skyway Bridge, a ceremony that says the old one may be gone, but we will now never forget why.
I have a feeling of closure, remembrance, and peace.
Through 35 years of pain, these people have waited for a monument to their loss. Children, parents, widows of the 35 people killed when the Skyway Bridge collapsed underneath them.
Charles L. Collins.
Reading every name is Bill DeYoung. He was writing a book about the Skyway disaster when he realized there was no memorial anywhere to the victims. So he raised the money to place this marker.
The time has come to trust that guiding light.
At the rest area on the Pinellas side of the new Skyway Bridge, these families finally have a place to remember.
Thank you.
still stinks, the tears still come. But now, they all know, we will not forget. One mother told me she has avoided this area since 1980, but today, she is now ready to drive across the new Skyway Bridge for the first time. In Pinellas County, Grayson Connell, 10 News.
I gotta tell you, the state of Florida did not want us to do that. The state of Florida, I have always believed, wanted to pretend that this thing never happened. You know, and that may be why there's so much misinformation or poor information out there about it. And when I said, you know, what would it take to put up a hunk of concrete with a plaque on it? Oh, we got all kinds of permits. And basically, it took me about 7 or 8 months to actually get somebody to return an email saying, yeah, you could do it. So we crowdfunded it, and everybody contributed, and it was $10,000. And we had this wonderful ceremony 7 years ago on May 9th, 2015. And I hope you might visit. The state has now put a sidewalk and a palm tree and meditation benches around it now. Suddenly it's the state's. But meditation is something we take very seriously when we think about this, because this didn't have to happen. And I want to tell you that the one thing that I regret about it is that I didn't put Captain Laro's name on the monument, too. I think that I've talked to every family member who came. They came from as far away as Canada, and they came from California. I've written stories about them in the St. Catalyst, their stories, and I think to a person, they now understand that it wasn't, you know, the drunk captain. They kind of understand what happened. So I hope that if you go and visit this, it's right where the new rest area is, near the Blackburn Memorial, the Coast Guard, that you'll stop for a minute and think about Captain Laro. And I thank you for your time.
Bill DeYoung, veteran journalist, senior writer with St. Pete Catalyst, author and historian. And his book, Skyway, The True Story of Tampa Bay's Signature Bridge and the Man Who Brought It Down. Happy Hour with the Historian series, the St. Petersburg Museum of History. Find out more at spmoh.com.